start. So, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Asia House. Let me know if it echoes too much or if there's any problem with hearing, but hopefully it'll be okay. I'm Jemima Steinfeld. I'm the Literature Festival Manager, and I'm also going to be your chair for tonight's event. I want to just quickly thank Barry Foundation for their continued support of our Literature Festival, as well as the Arts Council. So thanks for all coming on such a beautiful night. We've got a really nice night in store, which will be a really interesting discussion, hopefully kind of getting beneath the surface of Vietnam, and then we're going to follow that by celebrating some of the food aspects of it, and with a book signing. So I'm just going to get stuck straight in. I want to introduce the panel. In the middle here is Lucy Cruikshanks, who was born in 1984, raised in Cornwall. Her debut novel, The Trader of Saigon, was published in 2013 and was shortlisted for the Authors Club Best First Novel Award and The Guardian's Not the Booker Prize. Sitting next to me is Chuan Barry. She's a professor at University of Wisconsin, Madison, so has come all the way from the US. She's the author of poetry collections Asylum, Controvertibles, and Water Puppets, as well as her latest poetry book, which is called Loose Strife. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, amongst other publications. And her latest work, She Weeps Each Time You're Born, is her first work of fiction, and that's set in Vietnam. And at the end is Uyun Lu, who was born in Vietnam and spent the first 5 years of her life there before leaving in the aftermath of the war. She grew up in Hackney, arriving in Hackney with her mother and her young brother. She's a writer, photographer, and filmmaker, and most famously, a cook chef. And a cookbook writer of My Vietnamese Kitchen, which is a collection of recipes that it's not just about food, it's also about memory, biography, Vietnam in lots of ways. So I'm going to ask each of the authors a few questions, and then I'm going to open it up to the floor after that. So I'm going to start off asking Chuan some questions. You know, I don't know how many people in this room have been to Vietnam, but I think it's one of these places where If you've not been there, I think lots of people, you know, they have maybe kind of a limited knowledge. I personally spent 6 weeks there and absolutely loved it. And it would be really, really interesting to know, because you're from Vietnam, but you actually didn't return there until your 20s. So, you know, was it important for you to kind of write, to go back to your background, to write a book on your background?
When I was an undergraduate, I actually lived in Japan for a year, and while I was there, I did a lot of travel in Southeast Asia, which is sort of how I fell in love with the place. So I've traveled very extensively to very many countries there. So the fact that I chose to write my first novel about Vietnam, for me, it's not because I necessarily felt some sort of pull there since I was born there, but because I stumbled on a very interesting story. And basically, just to tell you very briefly about that story, it turns out that in Vietnam, it's a country in which, because of the war, 3 million civilians were killed. And so it's important to many people to find out what happened to their loved ones. So I was back in Vietnam in 2009, and I stumbled on the story of a woman who actually exists, who is the official psychic of Vietnam. And basically, her story is that she was bitten by a rabid dog when she was a child. And then when she came out of her coma, she can actually hear the voices of the dead. And she is someone who the Vietnamese government actually turns to when they want to find out where soldiers are buried or people who are prominent have gone unknown. And so when I stumbled on this story, that's when I knew I wanted to write about it. So it wasn't because I was born there necessarily that I chose to write about Vietnam, but because, again, I stumbled on this kind of amazing story.
Perfect. Yeah, so the book is wonderfully poetic. I think you can tell that you're a poet through the prose. It's really, you know, it's a treasure to read. You've just touched on your central character, Rabbit, and how you came up with the character. Can you tell us a little bit more about Rabbit?
So Rabbit is a girl who's born during the Vietnam War in 1972, and she's born under sort of mysterious circumstances, which I won't give away. And basically, we follow her life over the course of the next 30 years or so. And as she comes of age, she has various encounters where she hears, again, the voices of the dead in Vietnam, and she sort of gives voice to them. And so what I was trying to do in writing this book is I was thinking very much, particularly in the United States, unfortunately, Vietnam has become a metaphor. For us as Americans, when we think of Vietnam, we simply think of it as a quagmire. Vietnam, as a word, had been being thrown around with the Iraq invasion. People were saying, will Iraq be another Vietnam? And so it's true that in the United States, people don't know what Vietnam is as a country. And so one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book and why I wanted to have this particular character is she's someone who can give voice to Vietnam, not just for the last 25 years, but because she can hear the voices of the dead, she can also talk about the French rubber plantations. She can also talk about the emperors in Vietnam. So she can go back in time and more fully let Americans and other readers know what Vietnam is besides just being this metaphor for a quagmire.
Yeah, and I would say you do a really great job in kind of pulling in the history of Vietnam. You know, I'm assuming that was very important to you, that it wasn't just Vietnam, it's not just the war. So if you could, say a bit more about like how you kind of selected what bits of history you wanted to include.
So it was important to me, again, Vietnam has been around obviously for more than almost 1,000 years, and obviously I couldn't cover that much time, and so I decided that I wanted to focus on the last 100 years of Vietnam in particular. And so through this character, as I mentioned, I can go back and think about the last 100 years. And I could also find out what happened in Vietnam after 1975. A lot of Americans after 1975, we sort of brushed off our hands and we left, and we really didn't know what was going on there. And so, again, it was an opportunity for me to write about things that had happened previous to the American involvement there and also to follow up what happened after 1975, what happened to people who were left there as well.
Could you read us a brief extract?
Yes. So just to tell you a little bit about this really brief excerpt that I'm going to read, basically it's a secondary character. There's a secondary character in the book named An, and he was a soldier who fought for the South Vietnamese. And when the country reunited, a lot of South Vietnamese soldiers were put in re-education camps. And they were actually forced to build these camps oftentimes because they didn't exist. And so what I'm going to read is just a short excerpt about one man's experiences in a re-education camp. The very first structures they were forced to build were a series of small boxes barely big enough for a man to stand up in. The first man put in the box was a former student leader named Nam. But I protested against the war, Nam said over and over as they dragged him in one morning. Don't listen to him, the guard said. He is a traitor who has been to the great enemy. I have been to the United States, Nam conceded, but to lecture against the war. He said he'd been flown to America by anti-war organizations to speak with students in a place called Berkeley, another called Madison. The guards got his arms in and closed the door. A piece of wood shot through a bolt in the front to keep it closed. All morning in the hot sun, they could hear Nam's cries, at first like a small child, then like a wounded animal, and then nothing. The guards made a show of taking him out that night when the others came back from clearing the jungle. When they opened the door, he fell on his face, his body shaking, mouth white with foam. Two men were ordered to carry him over to the spot where they all slept out in the open. By morning, he was dead. The first time An got put in the box, it was a mistake. Even the guards knew he wasn't the one who had killed the hen out of spite. The eggs were strictly reserved for the camp chief. Comrade New was a slight man with a lisp and no mercy. When the hen was found with its neck snapped lying at the foot of New's house, even the guard shuddered. Among the prisoners, there was already a rumor circulating that one of the guards had done it because he was tired of watching New eat eggs every morning while the guards had none. An wasn't really thinking when he stepped out of line. He walked up to the front of the box. Behind him, hundreds of men were holding their breath. They had been threatened with group punishment if they didn't come forward. Four of the older men would possibly die from lack of water. Up close, the box wasn't even as deep as his arm, the thing basically an upright coffin. He closed his eyes and stepped inside. The guards stood staring at one another. "We'll shut it," someone said. The door creaked shut behind him, hinges groaning as if with pain. He could hear the sound of the bolt being rammed home. Inside, there wasn't even room to turn around or raise his arms. Later, he tried to tell the others it hadn't necessarily been unpleasant, that when the discomfort came, you had to settle into it. You had to make peace with the ants crawling up your leg, the smell of urine and feces as if you were steaming in them, because essentially you were, the sweat trickling into your eyes and the sting that became a blurry. He began to see colors. He could hear the sounds of the sea. Each time his blood coursed through his body, he felt the tiny kick as his heart whooshed it through. There wasn't even space to fall down. Before he blacked out, he knew if he came out of the box alive, he would make it through absolutely everything. It was out of his hands. The world would decide if he should live or die. He was starting to merge into an even greater darkness, heart shuddering like a drum, somewhere the ocean swelling like a graveyard. He knew somewhere someone was crying for him.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, as that shows, it's kind of this theme, it's quite haunting. It's, you know, there's a lot of death in your book. There's a lot of ghost stories. I wanted to know about the contrast in the way that you found people in Vietnam approach their history and also approach death compared to the US.
So in the West in general, not just in the US, but ghost stories tend to be stories that terrify us. So, you know, many of us are familiar with horror movies, you know. In the horror movie, the ghost is an evil presence. It's there to do harm. In a lot of Asian countries, because of ancestor worship, it's the idea that the ancestors are always with us. And so it's the idea that spirits aren't necessarily inherently evil. And so in the East, a lot of, not everywhere in the East, but in many places, people, again, approach communicating with the spirits as more of a cathartic sort of experience. And so, again, it's not seen as being horrific in the same ways that it is in the West.
Interesting. But there seems to be... We've just actually had a Korean writer, Hwang Seok-yeon, who also has a character that can talk to the dead. And it definitely does seem to be something where lots of writers from Asia do write about that. How did the audience, the non-Asian audience, kind of receive this? You know, were they skeptical? Were they appreciative? Did they like the fact that it kind of, you know, provokes the imagination?
So my book, the part that I just read is a very obviously realistic part about things that happen to people in the re-education camps. But I should say that overall the book uses a lot of magical realism. Some of us are familiar with the term magical realism when we think of Marquez, Gabriel Marquez, the Mexican writer. So magic and realism is a technique that writers use. It's not like Harry Potter or fantasy or that kind of thing, but it's when magical things happen in a very realistic world. And so in my book, there's a lot of magical realism because, again, this character can hear the voices of the dead. And so in doing that, it enabled me to create, to use more poetic language because of the sort of magical aspects. It also allowed me to have things happen in the book that are completely non-realistic in many ways. And in doing that, I think it allowed me to tell the story, not necessarily in a realistic way, but in a more emotionally realistic way. So the ways in which people react to reading, again, these stories which use, again, elements of ghost stories, though. But again, I think it hits at something more emotional than just, again, a more realistic telling would have. And so I think that's primarily how the magical realism element is working.
And so now that this book's out, have you left Vietnam behind in terms of your writing? Do you have more in store?
So I'm actually working on a new book about Mongolia. I was in Mongolia in 2008, and I'm not Buddhist, although I definitely have Buddhist tendencies. And so the new book that I'm working on is actually about... a few years ago, as many of you may know, the Dalai Lama had said for the first time, he said that he wasn't going to be reincarnated. And basically, he's trying to prevent the Chinese government from coming in after his death and naming who the new Dalai Lama is. And so he had said that he now has said that he's not going to be reincarnated. But the thing that he said a few years ago, which got me thinking, was he said specifically that he was actually going to reincarnate before he died. And I started thinking about that, like, what would that look? How would that? What? And so, in thinking about this, my book is not about the Dalai Lama, but it's about monks in Mongolia who go in search of a very prominent Lama. And so, it's kind of a little bit of a road trip, but again, they're searching for the reincarnation of someone. So, that's the new book that I'm working on.
Okay. Well, we'll probably come back with a few questions, but I'm going to go over to Lucy now. It's your book, which is set in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. I want to just first ask a question, which is, you know, you're from Cornwall. So what's a Cornwall Cornish girl doing writing about Vietnam? I mean, I lived in China and I've written a book on China, and, you know, I think people are just completely baffled, basically. And so I just want to put that out there too.
No, I do definitely get that reaction quite a lot. To be honest, it was almost accidental, I think, really. I went travelling in... around Asia for a period of time, and I had no intention of writing about it or writing about anything at all, really. And although I always thought that, you know, I had this one day I'll write a novel, you know, like so many people do, but don't actually pick up a pen and do it. And it wasn't till quite a few years later when I did think, you know, I am actually going to do this. I want to write a book. What am I going to write about? And it was the travels that I had in Southeast Asia, and in particular one meeting that had links to Vietnam that really took me there to write a story, because actually the novel that I've written is basically a human trafficking story. It's follows an American soldier who deserted the army and now sort of skulks through the shadows of post-war Vietnam pretending to be Russian and trading in women. And what brought me to write about that story was when I was travelling in Asia, I sat beside a man on a plane who sold Vietnamese brides, and he gave me his business card, and we had a very interesting chat, and he was really, really proud of what he did, and what he mostly wanted to talk about was how filthy, stinking rich it had made him. And from sort of my quite naive Western viewpoint, I was really quite taken aback that someone firstly really had these jobs, and secondly, you know, how flippant he was in describing what it was that he did. And so when I came to writing properly, he was the sort of character that I started with, although he's, you know, ends up very, very different in the book. And that's what took me back to Vietnam, really.
Did you realise that when you had that encounter with that man that you were like, this is it, this is the book?
No, not at all. It was years later, a good 3 or 4 years later, that I thought, you know, I'm going to write a novel. What should I write about? Oh, you know, and he was the character that was, I just kept coming back to. And I, you know, I like reading books about faraway places. I don't want to read a book about a girl from Cornwall. I want to read a book about somewhere that's different from where I live and that's going to take me to new experiences. And so that's why, you know, Vietnam seemed a great place to set the story.
And so how did you go about the research once you decided that? You went to Vietnam after meeting, you were travelling around Southeast Asia,
yeah.
You went to Vietnam and you really loved it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had sort of a base knowledge of the country, having spent time there before. And then I went back during the course of writing it as well to sort of, you know, refresh my mind and verify memories and to find out specific things that I wanted to find out that I'd found that I needed to along the way. But I mean, a lot of reading from, you know, in the English rainy winter, a lot of looking at photographs, you know, never underestimate the power of Google Images and YouTube, and because there's loads of historic videos on YouTube and things like that. So an awful lot of research, but I did go back as much as I could, really.
Because you have Alexander, who's the US Army deserter, and then you have Han, who's a rural girl, the one who basically gets embroiled in the trafficking.
Yeah.
And you also have Hook, who's this kind of former businessman trying to get back to glory.
Yeah.
How did you say that you base Alexander on this man that you met in the airplane, and what about with the other characters?
I think I wanted to have people from both sides of the war, essentially. Fook is a character who backed the wrong side, essentially. He's from the south. He ran a restaurant, and you know, he was sort of in with the Americans, and you know, he was in a very comfortable place. So when the country was unified, that was gone in an instant, and how that affected him, and then how he had to deal with overcoming the issues that sort of completely blew his life apart through no fault of his own. You know, it was circumstance and, you know, business that made him shoot, and geographical whereabouts of, you know, where he was that put him basically on the losing side. And with Hang, she's from Hanoi, and she's a toilet attendant, so she's very poor, and she's, you know, been really affected. Her father died in the war, and she's cares for her sick mother. But it's how she's still got that hope and that drive, and she wants to improve her life. She just doesn't know how, and that's what sort of leads her to Alexander, or leads him to her.
Well, it's definitely really pacey. I mean, it's kind of in the category of thriller, and the characters are really interesting, and they're not always likable. So I thought maybe you could just.
Well, where's the fun in that? I mean,
exactly.
I mean, I think characters don't have to be likeable for people to like reading about them necessarily.
If anything, we love the fallen heroes. If you look
yeah.
at some of the things you watch on TV, you know, Mad Men and things, they're all not particularly likeable. But yeah, I mean,
absolutely. I think you know, real people aren't black and white,
yeah.
and if everyone in every novel was incredibly likeable, they'd all be very dull. In my opinion. So I think the books that I like reading are things like Patricia Highsmith, you know, and all her main characters are utterly deplorable, really. But you still somehow end up rooting for them, and you kind of want them to come good in their own way, whatever that that means, really. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, saving the baby from a burning building like it might with your conventional hero, but they can have their own little victories and you can still be pleased for them and you can still root for them and like reading about them, I hope.
Could you introduce us to one or two?
Sure. You mean read?
Yeah.
Read? Yeah, absolutely. So this is an extract when Alexander, who's the trader of the title, goes to meet his mentor. The brothel was an ageing townhouse, squeezed onto a shard of land on a street on the edge of Hanoi's French Quarter. It rested in shade behind sycamore trees, and on days like this, where the wind blew east, the leaves were woken and waved like little girls' hands. Inside the house, the hush was uneasy. The herder was sitting at a table by the window, shuffling a deck of cards and dealing them out to the empty seats behind him. This was his brothel, one of many he owned throughout Vietnam. Alexander hesitated in the doorway. It was always wise to assess the herder's mood before barging in. He wasn't the sort of man to tolerate barging, but some days he took it worse than others. Alexander didn't like to make him angry. Even when sitting, his size was striking. His body seemed to swamp the tiny wooden table. Tall and broad, his jawbone, his neck, his shoulders and his chest were knotted tightly together and set like a great Russian bear. His hair hung almost to his chin. It was thin and straggly, clumped in rat's tails, and his lips were drawn by the slimmest of smirks, as if something amused him. He lifted a pile of cards from the table and fanned them between his enormous fingertips, considering his hand for a moment. Then he held his head just slightly down and looked out through the top of his eyes like a wolf. A little early for you, Alexander? Couldn't sleep. Too many women in your bed? No. He shook his head as if a scrap of tacky dream still clung to him. The herder laughed and looked at him pityingly. Of course not. Alexander pulled a chair from the table and eased himself down. He felt better already, just being here. He always felt better when he saw the herder. The herder had known him for years now, but he had known the herder for years now, but never by any other name. As far as Alexander understood, he had given himself the title. The herder called his girls straying cows. He found them at the side of the road, in dry fields or empty market squares, and he rounded them up. They were the poor, the unhappy, the lonely, and the lost. They had deep brown, innocent eyes and long, fluttering eyelashes. They were trusting. He promised them work or food or friendship, and they always followed him. His skill was masterly. Alexander remembered their first meeting well. It had been in a bar in red light Bangkok when the war was still raging. The night was sweltering, the air syrupy thick with spirits and sickly sweet perfume. Grunts and leathernecks, still in their military uniforms, sang, staggered and hooted at the girls who danced on the bar in their cheap lace bras, flicking their dark hair and childlike hips in time to the music. Alexander had sat alone in a booth, awkwardly hunched and uncomfortable on the fake leather seat. Sweat leaked from behind his thighs and the folds of his knees, and it dribbled from the hollow of his back to the crack of his arse. His leg twitched beneath the table. He didn't know where the rest of the boys from his platoon were. The chopper had dropped them in the city on a weekend pass from Pekou just a few hours earlier, and they had showered, shaved, and drunk two bottles of whiskey before heading out. They did not invite Alexander. He stared down and swilled his wine in a cloudy brown tumbler. He had asked for whiskey too, but the bar didn't have any. He took a gulp and the herder had sidled up to him, like a dream. He had sat unnervingly close. Though the music was blaring, he didn't raise his voice. He seemed to strike a tone that wriggled below the sound and swam to Alexander through the thick air, calm and easy. "You don't look like you're enjoying yourself. Don't you like my women?" he said in his deep Russian accent. "Not much," Alexander replied. He felt angry, but he didn't know why. "Why are you here if you don't want to go?" Alexander couldn't answer. He had been drawn to the neon lights, the noise, the crowds of people, the chaos. Not to the women. With the flick of his wrist, the herder cocked a Marlboro from a packet of cigarettes. He offered it to Alexander. "Are you enjoying the war?" Alexander frowned as he took the cigarette. He wished he was enjoying it. He thought he would do before he came here. He thought he'd enjoy it more than anything else he'd ever done. The herder held out a light and Alexander leaned in. "The first kill is like your first love, don't you think? It's unforgettable. My girls are unforgettable too. A man will only kill if he wants to live. These girls are here to remind men why they should want to keep living." He paused and smoke was held on his lips and in the hole of his mouth. "Do you want to live, soldier?" "I said I don't want to go," replied Alexander, the words sounding flat as he forced them out. He realised his hand was shaking and he placed it on his knee. The herder stretched his fingers around Alexander's wrists and steadied him. my friend, I have something far better for you.
I want to ask a question to both you two, and then I'm going to also bring you in after that, which is, you know, you pull in lots of different influences, but you also still kind of do talk about the war as kind of quite this anchor, and I want to know, for us, it's definitely is the big story, but in Vietnam itself now, do you feel that they're kind of then moving away from the war, that it's not as much of a thing in, you know, 2015 Vietnam?
So, yes, I don't think it's... First of all, Vietnam is a very young country. I'm not sure what the exact numbers are, but a large percentage of the population is under 40, so they really wouldn't have memories of the war. And then also, Vietnam has a long history of invasion by other countries. So when we think of the war, we think of the American war, but when the Vietnamese think of the war, they don't necessarily think of the Americans. They might think of the Cambodians. They might think of the Chinese. They might think of the French. And so, you know, as an American, when I go there, when I first started going, I would feel this great burden because of thinking of the atrocities the Americans committed there. And I found that, by and large, the Vietnamese didn't, you know, they wouldn't mention those things to me. I didn't feel like it was being held against me. At one point, actually, during when Obama was running for president, I had all these Obama stickers because I was a volunteer for him, and I brought them with me to Vietnam because I thought, maybe some people, and they did. I couldn't believe it. Like, people would see my sticker. And I actually gave one to a man who'd been a member of the Communist Party for 60 years, and he was so excited to get this Obama sticker. And so I do think that many of them, in thinking about the American War, they just put it in the context, like I said, of a lot of struggles that they've had.
Yeah, certainly my perception of it is that they are able to talk about it quite freely, and I think that's a good indicator that they've sort of come to terms with it, in a sense. I think when I've travelled to other countries, and my second novel is set in Burma, Myanmar, and you know they really can't talk about the past there, and the contrast between that and Vietnam, I think, shows how far that they've come. And I think as well they've done a very good job, in my perception, of sort of commercialising the war, actually. And you know, you can go to the Chu Chi tunnels and you can pay a dollar and fire a gun, and you can...
grenade a cow.
Yes,
as well.
And strange things as well. But, you know, that there is an industry around American veterans coming back as tourists, and the fact that they're able to do those things, I think, you know, shows certainly that they've come to a place where they can openly talk and they're comfortable with it. You know, obviously not, you know, over the moon, but they've dealt with it in their own way and moved on, I think.
I think that's very true, too, but I do think that one of the things to keep in mind is that, that there hasn't been necessarily a reconciliation between the North and the South. And so in thinking about it, you know, a lot of the memorials that you see are memorials for the Northern dead. You know, there are many ways in which the Southern dead aren't necessarily remembered in the same kind of way. So I think that's absolutely true that when it comes to thinking about the Americans and thinking about what happened there, they very much are open to talking about that. But within their own community, though, I'm not exactly 100% certain, you know, if there are still things, again, between North and South, and ways in which that still played out today.
Which would lead nicely on to asking you about some things. You know, so I think one of the biggest changes in recent years over here, the way we kind of know Vietnam is through the food. I mean, I think for my generation, for my parents' generation, Vietnam was war. For my generation, Vietnam is now Pho, or, you know, this place that you go travelling around. One of the things that has struck me about reading some bits from your book and reading interviews yourself is that you're very much, you cook Southern Vietnamese food. And I wanted to know, is this the kind of this difference between Southern and Northern? Is this more than just kind of, how does the food symbolise kind of different cultures? And how long has that been going on?
What, here?
Back in Vietnam.
Well, I can only, because I came here when I was very young, so I can only tell you my opinion of what my family says. So I don't know if it's actually true amongst the whole nation. But it seems like there is a massive divide between the North and the South with their personalities, and there's hardly any mention of the war with it or the political sense of how it came about, but just that they have such a conflict in personalities that they sort of disagree with the food as well. And, you know, I haven't really been to the north because I tried to go to the north and then we got so hungry we had to go back south. And we just couldn't find the palette for it. It was just me and my cousin. And we were just on our way, we were just going, and we were like, oh, let's just get back. We were so hungry that, you know, we were just living off instant noodle packs instead of proper food. Because our palate is much sweeter, and the northern is much more savoury, and so, and also with the herbs and the style and everything is quite different, and so I had to differentiate in the book that it's southern because there is a difference as well. And there's a difference with the central as well.
And do people describe people according to this? I know that in China, it's quite stratified that if someone's from Sichuan, they often say that they're kind of, oh, they've got such a spicy temperament. And people from Canton province, they say that they're very refined. And again, it's reflected in the dim sum. And I was wondering, does that come across that, you know, a southerner sweet?
Sweet or lazy. And then they'll say that the northerners are, you know, just salty and moody.
Does northerners say that, or does southerners
say that? The southerners will say that, and then the northerners will say the southerners are, you know, lazy and you're too easygoing.
And so, you left when you were five, and you've obviously spoken to you've been back since then. You know, how much do you remember of it from when you were five, and how much has it changed since then?
Well, I remember quite a lot, and what I remember is very vivid, only because I was five when I left, but. To be quite young and then to change your life completely, you would remember quite a lot of detail. So I remember obviously where I lived and my family and lots of memories there, and very, you know, little snippets like just the monsoon rain and the sound of it, and certain people who I saw, I still remember their faces. You know, I went back in 2000 for the first time. And I went to the neighbourhood, and I thought, oh my God, that's the person I often think about, who always used to walk past. So now I've forgotten the question.
So yeah, now that you've returned, how does it compare to your memories? And also, potentially, memories were kind of shaped even after you left from what you'd heard.
So when I came back for the first time in the year 2000, it was pretty similar to what I remember, except everyone got older. But then I came and I kept going back because I just really like to sort of find my roots there because the memories really stuck with me. Then, you know, year after year it completely changed, and then from month to month it changed when I used to go every 3 or 6 months, and, you know, buildings would spurt up, and one day, there was not one, just one day, but from one time, you know, no one had mobile phones or iPads, and now everyone has got everything. And in the supermarket, you can buy Italian delicacies and everything else that you would find here. And on one stage, it was so surreal because people had absolutely nothing. And also going back to the question that you asked before about... you know, if people resent the war or talk about the war, I find that no one talks about the war, but they always talk about what happened after the war. And when people try to escape and their escape stories, if that was successful, or how hungry they were.
What do you think is one of the things that modern Vietnamese are now kind of preoccupied with? Is there, you know, being on the border of China with kind of some of the tensions as well in that region, is that, do you think, from the people that you know who are still there, is that shaping what they're interested in?
Yeah, I don't know. My family, who I hang around with, they're slightly younger than me. They just seem to be only interested in technology and progression and perhaps being like China and getting rid of communism.
It'd be great to hear a bit about you coming to England and how you found it. I mean, has the Vietnamese community in the UK drastically changed in the last 20 years or so?
I guess so, because when we first arrived, I think there was about 5,000 refugees, and I think now there's 20 to 20,000 immigrants. So then I guess they're not refugees anymore. And it's a lot as well with a lot of young people, whereas who are just here because they are studying or they are wealthy and their family can afford their education abroad, or that they have family who would sponsor them. But when I came in the early 80s, it was, like people with families already, like my parents, for instance, so people in their 20s and 30s, and they were completely different because they were survivors, and they were here because they were going to die in Vietnam. So it's not like that anymore, I guess.
Well, I think I'm going to open it now up to the floor to ask some questions. Is there anyone to start us off? Don't be shy.
I think aspects of it, transferable, the human trafficking aspect, you know, is a global problem that could have been set in lots of places, but I chose to set it in Vietnam, and specifically in post-war Vietnam, because I felt that there's a lot of literature set in the war, and there's a lot of talk about the war, certainly in the West, and that's what people know about. And then there's like this great big black hole of what comes next. You know, history sort of stops for a lot of people, I think, in a Western removed situation. The war's over, it's fallen off the news. You know, what happened? And actually, in that black hole, I found was, you know, where things, seeds that were sown during the war, mushroomed. So the American soldiers were quite involved in sort of setting up the sex trade, really, in places like Vietnam and Thailand. When they were on R&R, they wanted girls, and there was an awful lot of really impoverished people who didn't have a choice really, except but to supply that. And actually, the black market as well, that sort of flourished during the war, just got bigger and bigger and bigger after. And there was so much scope, I felt, to explore what came next, you know, when the journalists leave, when the news crews leave, what's going on. And it certainly is an interesting context, I think, to set your story in. There are aspects that could have been transferable, but for me, Vietnam was a really interesting backdrop because of the war and its repercussions, and there's a lot, I think, in it on how the aftermath still haunts the characters, which wouldn't have been the same in other places.
Now, just, I mean, of course, the colonial in France, we also are very aware that, you know, the history of Vietnam is such a long history. It's so rich, and actually at some point, I mean, you touched on it, but you know, they were incredibly, you know, sophisticated, powerful kingdoms, and there's an incredible architecture, and you know, all of this. So that's just something that we're very aware of. It's not suddenly that they came up on the map. And then, of course, you're saying that now the young generation seems to be more turned toward the future. But how much are they, aware, or are they still, proud of such a, cultural history?
Maybe answer that.
So I can talk a bit about so it's definitely true that French literature, that Vietnam has a place in French literature, in a way that Vietnam doesn't have a place in American literature. In French literature, you have like things like The Lover, you have Indochine, you have all these great books about Vietnam. In America, by and large, most of the books that have been written in the last 25 years have been by returning soldiers, or they've been simply about the war itself. And so we just didn't have that kind of literature the way the French have. As to the idea of future generations in Vietnam or present generations, if they think back again on this longer history, I really can't, I don't know as much about that. It's definitely an interesting thing. I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts about that. It's true that, we were talking earlier about tourism. Tourism now in Vietnam, I'm sure maybe many of you in the room have been to Vietnam or are hoping to go. And so you can see ways in which, obviously, things are being preserved because of tourism. I don't have as much knowledge about it as I probably should, but, for example, the tradition of water puppets, which people maybe are familiar with, it's a tradition of water puppetry where the puppeteers stand behind a curtain and perform puppet and have puppets actually look as if they're moving through water. And my understanding is that, that's a tradition that goes back 1,000 years, but it's definitely true that because of tourism, that it's something that's being not only preserved but exported. I actually saw Vietnamese water puppets in Wisconsin. And so I think that one of the ways in which, again, these things that go back, cultural things that go back, again, thousands of years, are being preserved, again, through tourism and that kind of thing. But I'd be interested to hear other people's thoughts on that as well.
I think it links to the point you said about having a romantic sort of view of it, and actually that's what the tourists like to see in many cases. They like the romanticism of colonialism, strange though that is, and the buildings and the architecture, and certainly that's a motivating factor, I understand, in them keeping the buildings, particularly in places like, there's a French Quarter in Hanoi, isn't there, that I think has been restored in lots of ways. But the colonial period isn't something that I know a great deal about either, actually, and I think that says quite a lot, that certainly... and I found it when I was researching as well, that there is a great bulk of literature about the war and a great bulk of knowledge about the American war, a dearth of information. there's just not a lot, certainly, that I came across in people's perceptions. Not that it doesn't exist, but that just people aren't even aware of it, really. History sort of starts and stops either side of the American war, certainly. I think probably it's fair to say for a lot of people in England, and I guess that's why, again, I chose to set my novel after it rather than in it, to sort of broaden the horizons of, a Western audience, because they were the things that I were interested about. But, I'm not sure.
I think one of the most famous dishes is obviously the banh mi. And do you get people saying, wow, there's a baguette, I didn't think that you would have a baguette in Vietnamese cuisine? Or are people generally, do they kind of understand the history, where that's come from?
I think once you sort of point it out, oh yeah, it's really French-inspired, which is something that the French really left behind, this beautiful legacy of the food. You know, there is no gluten really in the food apart from this baguette that everybody has. And crepe caramel, which is... with my family, they really romanticise about the French and that time, even though they didn't really live at that time. And when there is a building with man who is a poet and he's selling the best creme caramel, people would go there in the night with their girlfriends and be romantic, which is nice.
So it's like the colonial period, it's it's so, like, there's a nostalgia to it.
Yeah, and also I think with amongst the people, there isn't much that survived the cultural revolution, in which so much was destroyed and wasn't told or wasn't allowed to be told. So it sort of got a bit blocked and just left to be romanticised instead of factual.
I think you might have touched this very slightly before. You mentioned it's all in the book that the voices touch on dinner and this history. I'm just wondering, the person between you three, how far do you think it has to go really for dinner to be represented in mainstream media, like TV and film, that it's not just a war-torn country or like or you know, forever associated with war, it's just that really up-and-coming, vibrant, dynamic country. I mean, how far do you think it still has to go with this?
Well, I personally think it's in England or in Britain, it's really hard to get anything across about Vietnam, unless it's about food.
I have to say, I packed that up. I was trying to find, I was looking at groups for this, and they were all food, getting these food groups.
I think because the lack of Vietnamese population in the UK also means that there isn't like artistic artists, I'd say, or writers, or culturally, you know, people who would do things to raise awareness of the culture and even the history. When I first came here in the 80s, you know, nobody knew what Vietnam was, and in here at that time, you know, people weren't aware about the Boat People or the war, and nobody really talked about it here. So it has been really, really ethnic, like really minority since the start, and now even writing recipes, it's really hard to get an editor to accept a Vietnamese recipe, never mind a Vietnamese story.
What's the kind of the US perspective?
So if I were to give a positive answer, like an optimistic answer, I would say it would be a generation or two. And the reason I would say that is because my generation of Vietnamese writers were still writing about the war, but not about the war in pointed kind of ways. We're writing about it more obliquely. We're writing about it more, again, sort of second-hand in certain kinds of ways. So I would like to think that the next generation after me will be Vietnamese writers, but not necessarily writing about Vietnam at all. And you can see that. So there's one writer in the United States. He's actually Australian. He's an Australian-Vietnamese writer named Nam Le. And his collection came out a couple of years ago, and most of the stories in that collection have nothing to do with Vietnam. There's maybe two stories in there that do. So in a positive way, I would think it maybe be, again, like I said, a generation or two who's just writing about all kinds of things. If I think of it negatively, then I have to admit that Americans sadly do not travel. We don't travel the way that Europeans travel. We don't have the same kind of vacations. I could go on and on about that kind of stuff. But because of it, so it's true that we just don't, because we don't travel, we don't see other countries in the same kinds of ways that we would if we were tourists there more. So, like I said, positively, a generation or two, negatively, unfortunately, the war. I think the war will, because, you know, it's the war that we, it's the first war that we lost, right? But it's not really the first war that we lost. We lost Korea. I mean, right. But in the consciousness, it's where America is, it's where the shit hit the fan, and from there on, it's, you know. So I think because of that, we will still be thinking about Vietnam in the same kinds of ways that we do now for a long time.
Thank you. Now, this might be a difficult question to answer, but my time in Vietnam, to a large extent, they came from the Northern country, the war is just those sort of people that sort of come from that, etc. So, in terms of literature in Vietnam, what are people writing about? Are you guys talking about the war? I'm pretty sure people wouldn't be writing too much about the war. You know, outside what's sort of pushing people's thought tends to be associated. So sort of in the more contemporary sort of space, literature space in Vietnam, what's being written about? What are the stories being told? You know, is it sort of a boon or is it, you know, is it some, you know, what are the sort of interesting sort of things going on in that space? Because I'm guessing people wouldn't buy too many books about the world, could be wrong, but yeah, interesting thoughts.
For 3 months. I think Lucy, your book was banned in Myanmar.
Yeah, they didn't. They didn't let my book be shipped in. So, I mean, I don't know whether that. I doubt that that was, you know, a high level official decision that they read it, they gave it a considered opinion, and thought, well, we'd rather not. I think it probably someone opened the box, they saw the blurb, and they thought that's not for us, and that was it. That's me gone in Vietnam, short of someone photocopying it and passing it to the street sellers. So I don't know necessarily whether, I mean, truthfully, I don't know what contemporary Vietnam writers in Vietnam are writing about at the moment, but I suspect that they still are limited in what they can choose to write about. And there is a famous Vietnamese writer whose name I'm going to butcher when I pronounce. You're going to help me out here. She wrote Paradise of the Blind, novel with no name, Dong Thu Hong, I think. And she, I believe, lives in France at the moment. And certainly, she was a North Vietnamese soldier, and she's written, probably 10 novels, and they're really scathing about the regime. And she's still writing now. And she's very well respected, as I understand it, in Vietnam. And the public are really keen to read her, and you get your bootlegged copies, but she's banned. And I think she spent time in jail when she was in Vietnam in the 90s, which I know is a little ago, but she's still writing about the same subjects, but she's had to leave in order to do it. So although I don't know what they're writing, I could have a guess about what they're not writing, and it wouldn't necessarily be through their choice that they're not writing it.
Authors may be outside Vietnam, you know, in the States or here or Australia, like that. It's sort of happened to maybe what some of those are writing about in a Vietnamese context.
So just to go back a little bit about, again, why Vietnamese writers, you know, can't write about what they want. I was actually there a couple of 3 or 4 years ago for the U.S. State Department. The U.S. State Department has this thing where they send writers to countries of interest, where they're trying to promote free dialogue. And so they want to expose writers in certain countries to other artists to show them the possibilities. Again, it sounds really, and that I talk about, I'm like, oh, it sounds really horrible. So when we were there a few years ago, we actually met with the Vietnamese Writers Association, which is the official organization of the government. So if you're a writer, you're supposed to belong to the Vietnamese Writers Association. Obviously, not all writers belong to this association. But if you do, it has certain perks. You can get publication. You can get published easier than if you aren't a member of this association. And so as far as subjects that they're writing about, obviously people who are members of this particular association tend to be older. Younger generations don't tend to belong to the Vietnamese Writers Association as much. Another thing that's big in Vietnam, again, I can't tell you subject-wise what they're writing about, but I have to say, happily for me, is that poetry is actually huge in Vietnam. They love poetry. People know living poets. There was actually a poet at this conference that I was at who's like a superstar. You know, he would talk about, he would go out and he could do it. People would want to know. Like he said that one night he went out and people were going through his trash, which in the United States as a poet, I cannot imagine. that would be, please go through my trash. So again, there's a large distinction between writers who belong to this particular association and writers who don't. And then as far as your second question, as far as what, you know, writers outside Vietnam, you know, the diaspora are writing about, you know, as I had mentioned, this other writer, Nam Lee, like, who, as I mentioned, was Australian. I think for him, I think this is going to start to happen. I can maybe see it happening a little bit in my own work. It's the idea that he tends to write primarily about other countries, about outsiders in other countries. So while he's not writing about Vietnam, he is writing about, again, like I said, I just keep using the word outsiders. He has stories that are set in South America. You know, there's a story set in Colombia about somebody who's working for one of the cartels in the 90s. You know, he has stories set in other places as well, but again, it tends to be more outsidery. I do think in general that when people are marginalized in certain kinds of ways, that's reflected in their literature, and that they do tend to write from point of views of sort of others. So that's just my guess.
And Ian, I mean, what did you read at home lots of English books, or did you continue to read books from Vietnam, and how one of your cousins who are still there reading?
Thankfully, with the communist regime, the really good thing is that they make you read and write at a really early age. So I can still remember that, but I wouldn't be able to read a book. So I read only Western literature.
Yeah. And what's your experience of when you go back there? What do you think there?
It's more meals and booths, like you said. And it's all about like romance, because they love weddings and love and drama. So I think it's tend to be that, because that's allowed and acceptable. Whereas anything to do with defacing the regime isn't. But the literature from other Vietnamese who have left, it's mainly all about belonging and being ripped apart and cultural changes, which I read throughout the years, and maybe because of my own circumstance, but it tends to be that.
I wanted to make an observation based upon some travels and some interviews I've done with some Vietnamese people in Vietnam for the past year and get some reactions to you. But I found that basically that, first of all, the Vietnam War itself with the American War is sort of distant memory because of the actual event. What is the predominant narrative now is a sense of betrayal against the regime and the communist government. People are very, very angry that what they sort of suffered for, I guess, in the previous generation, what they're going through now, basically, they've been taken away from them because they're having not opportunities. You've got, the government, you've got SOEs, state-owned enterprises that are basically taking up what it is, especially when it comes to land. Land was sort of redistributed around the country, now it's being sort of, expropriated back to the government, and far less than market values, and so there's a great deal of anger, and a great deal of oppression. So I think there's a very strong sense of betrayal that the people have against the government, and obviously because it's a very repressive regime, they can't talk about it. So I find that there's a voice that wants to get out, but they cannot get out. But if you could do that, because the rich cultural and artistic nature of the people, what would sort of come forth and be extremely strong?
I found when I was there, and I would try and have conversations with people, and these were usually through my guides who are Vietnamese. I don't speak Vietnamese. But the thing, at least with me, in front of, when it was sort of maybe a public sort of sphere, people's anger in the South wasn't necessarily against the government, but I think that's incredibly true, but it was more against the North in general.
But the North represents, it's noise. It represents the government and the political basis there, the commercial basis.
No, absolutely. But in thinking about that, they had really personalized it. So my guides, for example, would tell me their own stories about how they had tried to escape in the late 70s, but they weren't able to. And then when they came back, that they couldn't get jobs. That's why they were guides, because they couldn't get, weren't allowed entrance into certain universities and things like that. So the way to me that they had personalized the North, the government, they had personalized it about Northerners. They didn't talk in terms of the government, but they talked in terms of, well, the Northerners won't let us have X, Y, or Z, or the Northerners won't let us do these kinds of things. Again, this is just my anecdotal experience, like I said. So I didn't hear people, to me, actually talking about the government itself, but talking about Northerners. I definitely got that sense from talking with people.
I wonder if it's a generational thing as well, because I sort of think I probably spent more time talking to younger people, and I didn't get that sense of anger, really. I think they were more interested in their iPods and their mobile phones, and actually more forward looking and thinking about development and not just in a materialistic way. I mean, I make it sound they were actually quite hopeful for the future, and they were aware of the rate of development and that Vietnam was opening up and was more on the world stage, and they were much keener to talk about that, I think, the people that I met, than sort of rally against the past or talk about the divisions. But I think that might be a generational thing, possibly.
It's always hard, too, when you're a tourist in these countries, to remember what's happening there. So, you're trying to do research to find out, what writers are under house arrest, because there are writers under house arrest. What's going on as far as people being, you know, oppressed and not being allowed to say what they want. And so, I very consciously think about these things before I go there. But obviously, the United States, we don't have the best record either when it comes to human rights. And so it's always that. As a tourist, it's very easy not to know any of that kind of stuff is happening. And even as somebody who's tried to look into it, it's very difficult to find out what is actually going on. But again, sadly, that's true in a lot of different kinds of places. So, the hope is just, with Vietnam, the hope with China, and a lot of these places, is that technology will be the means by which these voices are finally allowed to be known.
And actually, a lot of bloggers, I think, in Vietnam at the moment, recently, there's been sort of a few backward steps, I think, in terms of, bloggers getting braver and then sort of getting...
It's gotten so bad that a lot of people are just saying, screw it. In fact, I don't care whether they go to jail. People have to sort of speak out against what's going on right now, because they feel like, they should be moving forward, but they're not. In fact, the government is blocking them.
It's interesting, again, when I spoke with these with a lot of Vietnamese writers at this Vietnamese Writers Association, which, again, is part of the Communist Party, a lot of them, they weren't necessarily older, but there were younger people there who I was trying to talk about the idea that, as a writer, you should be free to write about whatever you would want to write about. I'm like, I can have George W. Bush in a poem, and I can make him look, horrible, and that's my right. And they would be like, oh, yes, George W. Bush, of course. And I was like, well, Ho Chi Minh, for example, in this book by Monique Trung, who's a Vietnamese-American author, she has Ho Chi Minh depicted as a homosexual. And for them, the idea that you would do that to Ho Chi Minh was just... And again, these are people who are members of this particular writers association. So that's one of the reasons why we were there, was to try and talk about the different possibilities for what literature can do. So again, hopefully going forward, like I said, there will be more opening of what's possible.
I know you take photographs and things. Do you think that are there some boundaries that you feel you get to with how you want to kind of report your family background?
I think people don't... Well, the regime doesn't really care about what I do.
Because you're outside, you're in a safe zone.
Well, they don't now, but they did. Like, in 2000, I made a film there, and I had an official following me and bribing me and checking all of our sound bites and our footage. But now it's a lot more relaxed, I think. But you can still get in trouble.
Yeah. I think we've got time for one or two more questions. Well, I think we'll wrap up then, and you can ask questions later, and you can get some books signed, and yeah, we've got some food coming down soon. So thank you all for coming, and I want to say a big thank you to the three lovely panellists.